From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Gelton, and this is On Point. The U.S. government is promising to put a stop to an ongoing Russian disinformation war against this country. U.S. officials say the threat is indisputable. Last week, 13 Russians were indicted for interfering in the U.S. election process. And intelligence officials testifying in Congress warned that Russia already has our upcoming midterm election in its sights. This hour, On Point, Russia's information war, whether and how to fight it. You can join us on air or online. What did you make of the special counsel's indictments? Are you convinced we face a real threat, or is this just another scare reminiscent of the Cold War? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. And joining me now from Washington are David Salvo and Kate Brennan. David is a resident fellow at the Alliance for Securing Democracy, and he's a former U.S. diplomat who served in Russia and Bosnia. David Salvo, welcome to On Point.
Glad to be here, Tom.
And Kate Brennan is deputy managing editor of the online journal Just Security and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brent Scowcroft Center at the Atlantic Council. Kate, great to have you as well.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, David, I want to start with you. Former diplomat, served in Bosnia and Russia. You now are affiliated with an organization that is titled Alliance for Securing Democracy. Clearly, you care about securing democracy. What's your main takeaway from the indictment last week and the story behind it?
Well, I think the indictments corroborate a lot of what we've already suspected, and that is that the Russians have been using these asymmetric tools of power to try to destabilize and weaken the United States for quite some time now. I guess the indictments show that their campaign really started in earnest in 2014 and has only ramped up over the last several years. And it's also important to recognize that they're still conducting these types of influence operations. So, you know, the Russians' objective is not simply to install one particular candidate in office. It's to weaken Americans' confidence in their own democratic institutions and electoral processes.
Now, as you say, David, it started, this phase of the information war started in 2014. A lot of people have been saying, oh, Russia's been messing in our politics, you know, for 100 years. What is actually the story there? You know, how new is this?
Well, the tactics aren't new necessarily. The Russians have been using these so-called active measures for, like, as you said, you know, 100 years, certainly during the Soviet times. What's changed is the technological sophistication that really allows them to penetrate American society a lot faster and more and deeper than they perhaps could have using more traditional media platforms back in the Soviet days.
Kate Brennan, you know, this Russia investigation has come to be seen in such partisan terms, and we're seeing that same partisanship around the reaction to this indictment. Was this evidence of the worst foreign attack on the U.S. since 9/11 or even Pearl Harbor, or was it a laughable and amateurish effort by a bunch of Russian trolls? How do we honestly assess the significance of this?
I think your point's spot on. I thought on Friday, as both sides sort of seized on the indictment, that it's like a Rorschach test. You see whatever you want to see in it. Trump saw no collusion, and so did his supporters. The other side said, see, you know, how fast Mueller's moving and how much he has, you know, at his disposal and, you know, how powerful the investigation is and what's to come. So it really, you know, it is what you want it to be, but you do have to try to keep a clear head about it. And when you read the indictment itself, I mean, it's, you know, it's powerful in and of its own right when you read through the details of it. For me, what really struck me was that it wasn't just a cyber operation or a disinformation campaign. You know, this was on the ground. Political rallies were organized. One really haunting detail was that they paid an American actress to stand as Hillary Clinton inside a prison cell at one of these rallies. So, I mean, this was, you know, taking place in real life, not just, you know, online. But, you know, also to what you were saying before, you know, in the past, you would have had to send Russian spies, you know, to the country to pose as Americans. You know, it would require on the ground people. And because of Facebook and Twitter, you don't need to do that. And so your impact can be, you know, so much bigger. And, you know, you can do it all from far away.
Indeed. And the tools for this kind of information war have been improved so much. And yet, you know, there's something about this effort that seems small scale. I mean, compared to all the stuff that's on social media, all the stuff that's on Facebook, you know, $1 million a month, you know, how big is that? Back to you, David. You know, I think this is one of the things that people are stumbling over. You know, was this really a serious effort, or could the Russians have done a lot more if they were really determined to interfere in our elections?
Well, I think you have to look at the bigger picture. It's not just about a disinformation campaign that's waged on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. I mean, this is just one tool in, let's call it the Russian hybrid toolkit, where they use various tactics to try to undermine democratic countries and institutions. Cyber attacks, hacking, moving money illicitly into the country through shell companies and real estate transactions in order to peddle influence, using state economic tools like energy as a leverage over other countries, supporting political parties and civil society organizations. So it's not just about what you see openly on social media platforms, but you have to look at what the Russians are trying to do more broadly.
And in fact, back to you, Kate, as you say, President Trump and, you know, his supporters are saying that this indictment showed that there was no collusion between the Trump campaign and this Russian effort. And yet, as David just pointed out, all that the special counsel has reported on is just one phase of this interference operation. It's probably too soon to make any judgment about possible collusion, correct?
That's absolutely right. So the reason that Trump, you know, Trump and folks who support Trump, you know, reached the no collusion conclusion on Friday was because the Americans involved in this piece of the puzzle were unwitting, meaning they didn't know that the people they were talking to, the political activists they were talking to, weren't American, because the Russians were going out of their way to conceal their identity. So the Americans involved in this story were unwitting. But as David was saying, this is just one sort of tool in the toolkit. What's not addressed in this indictment is, you know, a separate thing that the Russians did in the 2016 election, which was hack the Democratic National Committee's emails and release them to WikiLeaks, as well as John Podesta's. So that is an entirely sort of separate operation that this indictment doesn't address. And in terms of that and, you know, so-called dirt on Hillary Clinton, from investigative reporting, we know that, you know, there are members of the Trump campaign that were interested in that, that had, you know, meetings on that, you know, whether it's George Papadopoulos bragging to an Australian diplomat in London about the Russians have dirt on Hillary Clinton, to Don Jr. meeting in Trump Tower about it. I mean, that's a whole separate story that this indictment just isn't about. This is about sort of the bigger picture and this disinformation campaign. So I totally agree with David. This is, while this might seem like small scale or just one side of it, you know, the 2016 election is a much bigger story.
You know, one thing I'm curious about is how much of an effect, you know, social media and fake news have on the way that people vote in the end. I mean, it's unknowable in the sense that you never can tell. You never know for sure what is on people's minds when they go into a voting booth. But I'm curious, David Salvo, if you have any thoughts about how important, you know, a social media-based information campaign would be in affecting the outcome of an election, the way people vote.
Well, as you said, Tom, it really is unknowable, but it almost doesn't matter. From the Russians' perspective, their main objective is to raise doubts in Americans' mind about the confidence that they can have in election results. So if they've been able to reach millions of Americans through online media ads, Whether or not those ads ultimately changed someone's vote, it doesn't matter, because here we all are having this conversation about whether we can trust the results of an election, or whether we'll be able to trust the results of the midterm elections in 2018 or the presidential elections in 2020, because these types of influence campaigns are going to continue and probably broaden in scope. So it almost doesn't matter whether or not they changed their minds, because we don't know. We're here trying to wrestle with this question. And that psychologically, that's already a victory for the Russians.
Well, one thing we should point out is that according to U.S. intelligence officials, the Russians actually expected Hillary Clinton to win this election. So I suppose it could be argued that their intent here was not so much to stop Hillary Clinton from getting elected and boost Donald Trump's chances, but to mess with Hillary Clinton's sort of strength, political clout. You know, assuming that she would be elected president, she'd come into office carrying a lot of baggage. I guess that's one way to look at this campaign, or the objective of this campaign, right, Kate?
Yes, definitely. And I think with all of this, I mean, one thing that sort of is most insidious about the role that Donald Trump plays in some of this stuff is that he often is amplifying whatever the Russians are intending to do. So whether it's undermining the election, if you remember before November 7th of 2016, you know, Donald Trump was saying, I'm not sure, you know, he was sowing his own doubts in the electoral process, saying, you know, I think it's rigged. I don't know that I'm going to accept the results because it's rigged. So that was sort of amplifying what the Russians were setting out to do. And he continues to do that today, to this day. You know, whether it's distrusting, you know, U.S. law enforcement institutions or distrusting American media. I mean, all of that continues to sow distrust, sow divisiveness. And so that, you know, is hugely problematic.
Yeah. And I guess it's fair to say that President Trump so far doesn't seem especially alarmed by these developments. He's relieved that they haven't fingered him or pointed to him personally, but he has yet to speak out forcefully against this Russian effort. We're talking about Russia's information warfare, that's their words, against the United States. When we return, we're going to speak with a reporter who recently went to St. Petersburg in Russia to see the troll farm where a lot of Russia's disinformation campaign was created. You can join this conversation. What do you think of how President Trump reacted to the news of Russia's interference? Do you think Russia can exploit divisions at the top of our government? I'm Tom Gelton. This is On Point.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton. We're considering what we have heard from the Justice Department and intelligence agencies about a Russian disinformation campaign against the United States. You can join the conversation. Have we reached the point where the politics has to stop and protecting the election process needs to go into high gear? Or are you still a skeptic? Follow us on Twitter, and you can find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And we have a number of comments already from our website and from Twitter. Dev says he questions the corroboration. He says, corroborated by what? Have we got any Russians testifying in any American courts? Another thought from a Twitter user who goes by the name Gumby Version. Gumby says, the Russians just took advantage of the partisan divide in America. They're playing both sides against each other. And one of the things that they have been doing is promoting this social media campaign with fake news that is written at a troll farm in Russia. My guests to discuss this information campaign are Kate Brannon. She is deputy managing editor of the online journal Just Security and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brent Scowcroft Center at the Atlantic Council. And David Salvo. David's a resident fellow at the Alliance for Securing Democracy and a former U.S. diplomat. David and Kate, before I come back to you, I'd like to turn to Dan Harris, who is a correspondent and an anchor for ABC News. He joins us from New York. Dan, good to have you with us.
Hi, Tom.
So we're just mentioning this troll farm, this amazing operation in Russia where you have people sitting there churning out these fake stories. You know something firsthand about that operation, don't you?
Yeah, I paid a visit to the so-called troll farm. They actually, in Russian, they call it the troll factory. And it's in a rather nondescript office building on the outskirts of St. Petersburg, which is one of the largest cities in Russia. It happens to be Vladimir Putin's hometown. And so a few months ago, I went to that building and tried to get in. And we didn't make it much further than the front door. The security guards freaked out, basically, and started screaming and yelling and cursing at us and threatening to call the police and pushed us, me and my crew, out the door. So you can tell this is not something that the Russians want anybody to see. Although there have been some hidden camera videos that have leaked out of there, and what you see on the inside is pretty much what it would appear to be your average .com, you know, rows and rows of young people, trolls paid by the Russian government, apparently, to create fake ads, fake news, personas, online personas, where they say all sorts of provocative things. And you can see there's reasonably tight security in there as well.
And what you found out is that the people that work there don't like to talk about what they do there.
No, they don't. But we were able to get in contact with a young woman who is a journalist who went undercover in the troll factory back in 2015. She was working there for about $700 a month, which is quite a good salary in Russia. And in fact, that's part of how they attract people, smart people, to come work for them. They pay at above market rates. And her name is Ludmila Savchuk. She's a mom and a journalist, as I said, an environmental activist. She lives near the troll factory. And what she explained to me, which is really interesting, and a lot of Americans don't know this, is that this trolling campaign really began as something aimed at the domestic market in Russia, that this was information warfare meant to perpetuate Putin's power internally. And so, in fact, what this woman was doing was creating online personas. One of them was a fortune teller. Fortune tellers are quite a big deal in Russia, apparently. And she would write all sorts of things about fortune telling and her life as a fortune teller. And then she would be told to slip in sort of anti-Ukraine sentiment or pro-Putin sentiment. And so it was reasonably sophisticated. So she was not in the department that was focused on the United States. She was in the department that was focused more internally. There have been others who were in the department focused on the United States who have spoken out publicly, and they describe creating multiple online personas. Yeah. You know, they'd switch from being a white person in Kentucky to being an African-American from New York City. And some of them, we now know, even traveled to the United States to sort of get some on-the-ground intel.
So, Dan, they're making stuff up. They're making stories up. They are creating personas. I mean, to me, this just sounds like the height of cynicism about democracy. Do they have any shame or any qualms about making up all this fake news?
Well, it's sort of I have two things to say about this. One is it's sort of multifactorial what they're doing. So they are making stuff up. They'll make up ads. They'll make up fake news. But they're also getting into online discussion threads and making provocative comments about actual news to sort of juice the already existing political divides in the United States and, of course, domestically. And by the way, there was a recent congressional report showing and this is written by the Democrats in Congress, showing that there's a massive information warfare campaign aimed at neighboring countries to Russia. So ground zero is really Ukraine, which, as we know, the Russians have seized, annexed territory from Ukraine, and they're actively fomenting civil war in the eastern part of the country for years now, but also in countries that will be more familiar to American listeners, like France and Germany and Sweden. And in some of these countries, they're now doing things that Americans may want to pay attention to, which is they're actively, in Sweden in particular, launching programs, government-funded programs, to teach children in schools media literacy so that they can tell what is fake and what is nothing.
Wow, this is really interesting. Dan, I know you have a lot on your plate today. Thanks so much for joining us and sharing those anecdotes from your time in St. Petersburg.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. Dan Harris is a correspondent and anchor for ABC News. I'm going to go back to our other guests now. David Salvo, a resident fellow at the Alliance for Security and Democracy and a diplomat who served in Russia and Bosnia. David, as Dan Harris just mentioned there, the Russians don't just do this with the United States. They do it in their own countries, and they do it in their own country, and they do it in other countries in Europe, for example. How big a deal is this internationally, and how much of a concern is this for not just the United States, but for other governments who have been targeted by a kind of a disinformation campaign like this?
Dan's exactly right. First of all, there is a domestic component to what the Russians do. Obviously, their democratic governance and open and transparent societies are inimical to an authoritarian regime like Putin's Russia. And so they're not only trying to stunt the growth of democratic society in their own country, but if they can weaken and destabilize democratic societies throughout the Euro-Atlantic space, Putin can point a finger at the West and say, you see how disoriented and weak and corrupt and unstable the West is? Do you really want to be like that? So he's trying to justify his own hold on power by subverting the West.
Let's go now to the phone lines. We have Derek on the line from Chicago, Illinois. Derek, welcome to On Point. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's good to be here. I used to contribute to RT for 2 years, Russian television, Russia Today, and I covered U.S. foreign policy as well as international relations.
Out of Moscow or out of the United States? Where were you based?
Out of U.S. and also out of Ukraine. I covered the situation in Ukraine, and originally I got involved in covering the Ukraine, specifically what I saw on the ground in Kiev, where I actually was one of the very few reporters who actually saw the overthrow of the government over there with U.S. assistance. So what really troubles me with this narrative that you're having today, specifically your two guests, it seems to me that there's really no alternative view to what's really being presented here. Specifically, you know, I would have journalists such as Glenn Greenwald from Intercept or Mark Ames from Pound of Daily actually have covered extensively involvement of the U.S. media narrative in shaping the public perception here. And I think it's really troubling to me to see that migration of the Russian involvement narrative from hacking the emails of Hillary Clinton to, quote-unquote, trying to create some kind of involvement of the outside power into the U.S. electoral process. And when it was disapproved by recent hearings in U.S. Congress, specifically when it comes to the influence of the social media, how much money was spent and how many users were, and so on and so forth. Now the whole narrative is migrating into some kind of a hybrid warfare of trying to overthrow the Americans' confidence into the political system here.
Okay, let me interrupt for a second, Derek. It's not as though the narrative has migrated. I mean, the story of hacking the Democrats' emails, the WikiLeaks part, these are still very much alive. We haven't heard from the special counsel on those matters yet, but we do know they are investigating them, and we've hardly left that part of the narrative.
Well, Counterpunch magazine actually last year did really excellent reporting on this, specifically by involving one of the British diplomats who was speaking in person contact with Julian Assange, specifically that he disclosed this, and with several different news outlets followed that story as well, including Real News out of Baltimore, specifically stating that it was actually internal leak, not a hacking itself. So there's just seemed to me, you know, there's a migration of a narrative, including, for example, false presentation of facts, like all U.S. intelligence agencies, 17, I believe, were on the same page of denouncing the situation. And then the whole story was retracted both by New York Times and NPR as well. So it seems to me that there's manufacturing of the narrative here into something that really isn't. And specifically, it's played to the political benefit, either okay. One side versus the other.
Okay, let me get Kate Brannon in on this conversation. Kate, the last thing that Derek just said there is that it's wrong to say all U.S. intelligence agencies joined in this assessment. And, of course, that was back in January 2017. But, in fact, the three leading U.S. intelligence agencies, the CIA, the Director of National Intelligence, and the FBI, did join in that assessment. It was only the minor intelligence agencies from some of the military service branches and the State Department and the Department of Energy, who really don't deal much with these issues. But aside from that, I mean, what about this larger charge that Derek is making, that so we're too quick to sort of jump on this meta narrative and not careful enough about nailing down the facts?
I mean, I didn't totally follow what Derek's critique was. And that last point is something that Trump himself has repeated, that, it's not true that all intelligence agencies agreed on this. There was some disagreement, I think, early on about when Russia decided to go, to back Trump. But by the time the intelligence assessment was released, I believe that they were all on board. And I think something that's important with Friday's indictment is you have to remember this went in front of a grand jury. This isn't, this isn't coming from the CIA or the FBI. The grand jury is made up of, regular Americans, and there was enough there for them to sign on this as well, which makes it so much more difficult, I think, for Trump to deny it. And that's, something we've heard a lot since Friday. So I think, I don't think that the media is being misled. I think that, reporters are, working like crazy to get to the bottom of this. I don't think that we don't have all the information yet. We don't have all the facts yet, excuse me. But I think, I wouldn't criticize the way that, news organizations are handling this.
All right. Well, Kate Brennan is deputy managing editor of the online journal Just Security. And let's go back to the phones now. We have John, who's on the line from Detroit, Michigan. John, you have called On Point. You're on the air.
Thank you. And thank you for taking this discussion in a little more broad conversation. Let's stop talking just about the elections and talk about all the things that not only the Russians but foreign entities are doing to influence and divide and conquer this nation. I mean, they're not sending in military to assassinate anybody and blame it on them, but they're doing it with the social media. They are pitting Americans against Americans, and we're just left in the diversion and the smokescreen and not paying attention to the big picture. And we've got to stop just putting this down as them influencing our elections. They are dividing the citizens of this country.
Yeah. That's a good point, John. Thanks for that. And David Salvo, one of the things that's really interesting, I think, about the Russians' social media campaign is how good they were at identifying the kind of neuralgic points in American politics, the points where we really do have strong and divided feelings, and really zeroing in on those sort of culture war and political war points.
That's exactly right. This and the caller is exactly right. This is so much broader than Donald Trump in one particular election. We've seen the Russian influence operations online targeting the recent school shooting in Florida and the Charlottesville protests and the NFL take a knee protests. So
yeah, and that has nothing to do with elections, does it?
Precisely, it doesn't. And even when they do target politicians, they don't just target Hillary Clinton and Democrats. They've gone after Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan. And President Trump's CIA director, Mike Pompeo, has said that the Russians are going to do this again. So this is not just about Republicans versus Democrats or Donald Trump being in office. It's a much broader, more insidious campaign against Americans themselves.
So, David, there's one other question I want to put to you, and it's one we haven't gotten into yet, and that is how much of this kind of stuff does the United States do in its work abroad? I mean, you're representing an organization that promotes democracy. The United States is active in a lot of countries that aren't democracies. What's the U.S.'s own track record when it comes to interfering in other countries' political processes?
Well, I think certainly in recent history, the United States has been a lot more transparent about what they do to promote democracy abroad. I don't think there's an equivalence between the United States government funding NGOs, let's say, in other countries to conduct the same sort of work that NGOs conduct here, and that's to strengthen political parties and build civil society and expose corruption. So, we're not trying to covertly manipulate public opinion in another country. I think we're trying to strengthen democratic institutions abroad because we see that as in our interests as well. So I think it's much less insidious, and I think, frankly, we have the moral high ground in a way that these types of campaigns can't claim to have.
Of course, we haven't always been totally transparent about our efforts. There have been covert efforts as well, perhaps not so much in recent years, but certainly in the past.
Absolutely, but I think we've had a reckoning about that and as a nation, and I think there are way more checks congressionally and legally than other countries have on their...
Well, Kate and David, I want to thank you both for your time. Kate Brennan is Deputy Managing Editor of the online journal Just Security, and we have some of her recent reporting on our website, onpointradio.org. Kate, thanks to you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And David Salvo, a resident fellow at the Alliance for Securing Democracy and a former U.S. diplomat. Thanks to you, David.
Thanks very much, Tom.
And when we come back, we're going to talk with two people who have put a lot of effort into Russia-proofing the midterm elections later this year. We're going to want to explore how we can improve the security of our election systems, our ballot booths, voting tabulation. You can join the conversation. Did you shudder when intelligence chiefs Mike Pompeo and Dan Coats warned that efforts are already underway in Russia to disrupt our upcoming elections? I'm Tom Gelton. This is On Point.
Before we get back to the show, we'd like to ask you about you. That's right. We want to learn more about our listeners with a short survey. It's anonymous and easy. Just go to wbur.org/survey to complete the survey right now. That's wbur.org/survey. This survey will be tremendously helpful to us. So thanks.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton. Now we're going to dig deeper into what election officials in voting districts around the country and government agencies in Washington are doing to secure our elections later this year from Russian information warfare and hacking. Last Tuesday, the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, confirmed that Russia and other foreign entities were likely to conduct cyber attacks on the 2018 U.S. midterm elections this fall.
Persistent and disruptive cyber operations will continue against the United States and our European allies, using elections as opportunities to undermine democracy, sow discord, and undermine our values. There should be no doubt that Russia perceived that its past efforts as successful and views the 2018 U.S. midterm elections as a potential target for Russian influence operations.
An independent senator from Maine, Angus King, weighed in on this discussion. He criticized the Senate Intelligence Panel for lacking a clear plan to fight back against Russian cyber attacks on American elections.
They will work to use cyber operations to achieve strategic objectives unless they face clear repercussions for their cyber operations. Right now, there are none. How are we ever going to get them to stop doing this if all we do is patch our software and try to defend ourselves?
And this is what we're going to be talking about in the rest of this hour, how we can secure our election process for the next round of elections. You can join our conversation. Has your town or city started preparing for the 2018 midterms? Are you ready? Are your voting booths safe? Follow us on Twitter, and you can find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And to talk about this, I'm joined now by Matthew Masterson in Silver Spring, Maryland. He is the chairman of the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. It's an independent, bipartisan commission that helps local governments improve their voting systems. Matt, thanks for taking the time to join us today.
Thanks for having me on.
And joining us from Denver is Amber McReynolds. She is the Director of Elections for the City and County of Denver. She and Matt were both at a conference in Washington this weekend that was devoted to this challenge of securing our election process. Amber, welcome to you.
Hi, Tom.
So let's go to you, Matt, and give us the sort of the debrief of that conference. You had state election officials from all over the country meeting with U.S. intelligence people about the cybersecurity threats that they need to deal with. What did you take away from that meeting?
Yeah, thanks for having me on and the question. My first takeaway is that all of us from the federal government on down to the state and local election officials view this threat as real, as serious. Sophisticated actors are targeting our systems, and the way to respond is to have a coordinated response together in order to protect the systems and prepare to detect or recover from any incident that we have. And then the second is that there's a lot going on and being done to help do this, not just within the government, but also private sector efforts like the Harvard Belfer Center's Defending Digital Democracy effort, or even services being provided from huge companies like Google and Cloudflare, who are jumping in and trying to help state and local election officials protect their systems. So there's a coordinated effort and response going on right now because the threat is real, and we all recognize that.
So, Amber, as Matt just said, the threat is real. We know the Department of Homeland Security has reported that Russian hackers tried to gain access to voter registration files or public election sites in 21 states. Did you come away from this meeting this weekend alarmed or reassured, Amber?
Well, so there's a few things, and I really believe that elections are very much about being proactive and mitigating risk. And we over time have had to face various challenges, whether it's on the security front or misinformation front, just generally, right? So separate from what's happened as of late, we have experienced similar types of issues in the past, especially with misinformation. So as Matt mentioned, some of the resources that are out there, Belfer Center and Defending Digital Democracy, are going to be great tools. And you know, the Belfer Center actually visited Denver last October during our most recent election to see what we were doing. They documented much of it, and many of the recommendations that they've put in the playbook we already had in place. And so we were really happy to contribute to that report and share best practices from what we've been doing here in Denver.
And so what are some of the things you've been doing, Amber?
So, creating a proactive security culture is one of their first recommendations, and that We very much have had that in place for many years. For us, it's been about commitment to that, collaboration, coordination, and then communication around it. We have the City and County of Denver, elections is part of the network structure, the technology structure in the city. So we really work closely with our technology services department to make sure the jurisdiction as a whole is secure. And then we do various things operationally during the election process to, number one, prepare, but then, number two, monitor during the election process to make sure that we are secure and that we are not, experiencing outside influence or anybody trying to get into our systems.
Matt Masterson, have there been efforts by Russians or anyone else to actually hack into these systems and change votes enough to perhaps even change an outcome? And have any of those efforts, have any of them been successful?
So the intelligence community has been unanimous in their response to that question and indicating that they have seen absolutely no evidence that any votes or voting machines have been hacked, accessed, or votes changed. So the intelligence community's assessment is there's no evidence of that.
But have there been efforts to do that?
Not according to the information that the intelligence community has offered as far as what they saw, the activity they saw, and the information that they have.
And what's your assessment of the vulnerability of those systems?
So there's been a widespread effort across the United States to address those vulnerabilities and put in place both security protocols, as Amber mentioned, proactive security protocols to secure the systems. So election officials have been working for years, really since just after the 2000 election, to secure their election systems, but then also build resilience in the process, which means the ability to recover, detect and recover if there is an incident. And that starts and ends with the ability to audit the systems, the auditability of the ballots, to be able to check after the election to make sure that the results are correct and that the votes were counted as cast. And so the elections community as a whole over the last 6 to 10 years has really moved in a direction towards auditable records and the ability to conduct efficient audits of those records to ensure, again, that the election outcome is correct. So I think that's at the core of where this community is headed in order to secure the process.
So, Amber, Matt just mentioned ballots. You know, I remember the first time I went to vote and found an electronic system in place. I thought it was pretty cool. It seemed pretty efficient. But are we now moving back to paper ballots? Do we consider paper ballots to be more secure than electronic voting?
Well, I think we need a system that can be audited. And so in Colorado, as an example, our voting model now is such that we actually send out a mail ballot to every single voter prior to each election. So most of our voters, over, you know, 91 to 95% of our voters that participate, vote using that paper ballot that was mailed to them. We also have vote centers, and you come in and you vote on basically what we consider a ballot marking device, and that produces a paper ballot that then goes into the ballot box, which we centrally count. So we've gone away from sort of voting machines that have cartridges that then need to be read or transferred, and so everything in our system has a paper ballot. And then post-election, we now do what we call risk-limiting audits. And audits and the design of audits is really important in terms of what happens post-election to make sure that no one was interfering with the process.
Matt, how much can the federal government do here? I mean, voting is, for the most part, you know, a state or local issue or responsibility. What are the is there any sort of new legislation that might be needed on the federal level, or ramped up efforts by the federal government to ensure voting security across the country?
Yeah, there's an effort right now as part of the Department of Homeland Security's in January of 2017 designated election systems as part of the nation's critical infrastructure. And as part of that, the Election Assistance Commission, working with the Department of Homeland Security, has put together a government coordinating council comprised of mostly state and local election officials, because, as you said, elections are run at the state and local level, in order to ensure two main purposes. One is the sharing and dissemination of timely and actionable threat information. So as information becomes available, it's incumbent on the federal government to push down threat information in a timely manner so that folks like Amber can act on it and move to secure their systems or review their systems based on the information they receive. And so the Department of Homeland Security has moved quickly to put into place information sharing protocols so that the folks at the state and local level can receive that information and secure the systems.
Amber,
the
have you... Sorry, go
oh,
ahead.
I'm sorry.
Finish. No, finish, man.
I was going to say, the second is getting resources down to state and local officials. And those resources come in the form of cyber hygiene scans or on-site assessments that the Department of Homeland Security can conduct to find or look for vulnerabilities in systems and help state and local officials address those. And so that's the federal government's two main efforts working in coordination with state and local officials.
That's Matt Masterson. He is chairman of the U.S. Election Assistance Commission, which is an independent bipartisan commission that helps local governments improve their voting systems. And Amber, I wanted to go to you and ask whether you have seen any change, any improvement in that threat sharing information coming from the federal government. I presume you've, you know, been around a time or two with past elections. How do you see that information sharing progressing?
It has improved greatly, and it even started improving prior, you know, kind of leading up to the 2016 election. In Denver, the city as a whole, and where elections are part of that, have been engaged with DHS, the FBI, MSISAC, many of the federal resources over time, because we need to secure our jurisdiction and fend this off. So this has kind of been an ongoing process for us for years. I actually invited the Department of Homeland Security officials from D.C. as well as our local officials to observe our election this past November in 2017. They spent the day here, and we walked them through the process. We explained everything that we do, and I think it gave them a better understanding of what we're facing at the local level and how we utilize their resources, how we consume information from them. And so a lot of what we do has now come into a lot of the resources that are being put out. So we're, you know, happy to be on kind of the leading edge in a lot of ways, and then we want to continuously improve and look for other opportunities to get better, more agile, you know, get more proactive even with what we currently have in place.
Let's bring one of our listeners into the conversation now. It's Gene. He's on the line from Tampa, Florida. Gene, thanks for calling On Point. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I have an issue understanding that when people are trying to reassure Americans that everything will be okay in the upcoming elections, that the site like Matt, I think one of your guests just say that the executive is one of the actors here doing everything to make sure that things go right. But I find it alarming when our president refused to criticize or to even admit that there is such problem. And is there any grown-up in the room here to look into why the president is so reluctant into accepting the fact?
Okay, Gene. And I take from what you're saying, you're concerned about leadership from the executive branch, and in particular the White House and President Trump, on this issue of cybersecurity in our election process. Matt, I'll let you take that, but I actually want you to expand it a little bit. Go back to that quote we heard from Senator Angus King at the top of this segment, when he was very critical about the lack of a plan, he said, to fight against these cyber attacks. He said, how are we ever going to stop them if all we do is patch our software and try to defend ourselves? How do you feel, Matt, about the kind of support or urgency that this effort is getting, the attention this effort is getting, not just from President Trump, but from Congress as well?
Yeah, I think our work with the Department of Homeland Security and the state and local election officials who actually run elections has had a ton of urgency, and there's been a real push really since 2016 to get this information sharing protocols in place, to get election officials in the room with federal officials to share information, to share those resources. And so from our perspective at the Election Assistance Commission, this has been priority number one coming out of the 2016 election to help those who are on the front lines, right, the state and local election officials on the front lines, to have the resources that they need, to have the information that they need, and then to partner them up with not just a governmental response, right, as I mentioned before, but work with communities and private sector actors and even white hat hackers that have a real skill set that could be useful to the elections community. And so, again, this needs to be a coordinated whole-of-nation response working with the elections community and America's voters.
And you're satisfied it's a bipartisan effort with bipartisan support?
But there has been Democrat and Republican secretaries of state, Democrat and Republican local election officials, those of us, a bipartisan agency at the Election Assistance Commission,
yep,
all at the table together responding to this. Absolutely.
Super. All right. Matthew Masterson, chairman of the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. Matt, thanks for joining us on Point.
Thank you.
And we also have had Amber McReynolds. She is director of elections for the City and County of Denver. Amber, we appreciate your time as well.
Thanks, Tom.
And you can continue this conversation about the integrity of our election system. You can get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, Pennsylvania's Supreme Court has redrawn congressional maps, and President Trump isn't happy about it. We'll talk about partisan gerrymandering. I'm Tom Gelton. This is On Point. Thank you.